Thank you. So the title of my talk is Fear Plus Brains Does Not Equal Zombies. We'll learn a little bit more about that later. My name is Catherine Prater, as Mariah mentioned, and I'm a graduate student in neuroscience. And tonight, I would like to tell you a story about my three imaginary friends, Freddie, Fiona, and Phil. Now, it was a dark and stormy night. Oops. Those guys weren't supposed to show up to party yet. But Freddie, Fiona, and Phil were walking down the blood-red hallway of their dorm, and they were joking and laughing, having a good old time. And they were suddenly surrounded by a horde of zombies.
Brains.
And each of these three friends responded to these zombies in a slightly different way. Freddie, he looked at those zombies surrounding him, and he was like, all right, what am I going to do? I'm going to grab one of these candelabras off the wall, and I'm going to fight these zombies. And he fights, and he fights, and he fights until all of the zombies around him are dead. Fiona takes one look at those zombies, screams bloody murder, takes off down that hallway. And zombies are kind of slow, so, you know, she got away. Phil, on the other hand, Phil is frozen in terror at the sight of these zombies. He is literally paralyzed with fear. And unfortunately for Phil, that's not a very good response when it comes to zombies. So you've probably heard of the flight or flight response. And you may not have heard of freeze. But these are the three sort of canonical responses, behavioral responses to fear for humans and other animals. So it might be a really useful thing to fight off a scary attacker. It might be a really useful thing if that attacker is a lot bigger than you to flee away from that attacker or scary thing. And freezing is, it's the, like, oh, there's something here. It's actually really useful for hiding. So if you're in the dark, freezing is a nice fear response. Also, if you're hiding from the Tyrannosaurus Rex in Jurassic Park, very useful. But, and there are many things in our world that we should fear, like fire and explosions, angry bears, and last but not least, zombies. But what if these fear responses were not in response to something that we would naturally fear, like fire or zombies? But what if Fiona's fear response of that scream of bloody murder and running out the hallway, down the stairs of her workplace, out into the street, she cannot return to work until that itty-bitty harmless spider way up near the ceiling is squished by someone else? That would be an example of a phobia. What if Phil's response of being frozen in terror and fear, what if that was in response to simply the idea of speaking to an audience such as yourselves? He didn't actually have to do it, but he was thinking about it. That would be an example of social anxiety disorder. What if 6 months after fighting off those zombies so valiantly, Freddie walks back into that blood-red hallway and is suddenly overwhelmed with terror? He's reliving that night and fighting off those zombies, and his palms are sweating, and his heart is racing, and he's totally terrified. That would be an example of post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. All of these are examples of the fear response, those natural responses that we have to fight or flight, or fight or flee or freeze, gone a little bit wrong. and maybe in response to things that we shouldn't necessarily fear. So as a neuroscientist, I like to know about the brain. So I was interested when I came to graduate school in learning about how the brain makes fear, how we learn about fear, how we learn what to fear and when. And what's interesting about the brain and fear is that I think by learning a little bit about how the brain interacts with fear, we can actually learn who in our audience tonight is a zombie. So I'd like to take a poll, actually a couple of polls. How many of you are in possession of a brain in your head? Excellent. Now, I would argue that zombies do have a brain. It may not be a fully functional one.
Cheers to that.
But they have one, just like hopefully all the normal humans do too. Now, this next part of the brain that we're going to learn about is what allowed you to raise your hand last time. So if you did that, you should be able to do that again. This is, as Susan mentioned, the motor cortex. So how many of you have a motor cortex? Excellent. Good. So zombies, I think, do have a motor cortex. They can move, albeit, you know, kind of shamblingly, maybe kind of inebriated-like. Maybe their cerebellum's not working very well. But they can move, clearly. So they have a motor cortex. Now, this next part of the brain is where it actually gets interesting. So how many of you have been scared? Or how many of you have an amygdala? Raise your hands. Keep those hands up and look around you. If someone is not raising their hand, they are most likely a zombie. I see, you know, a whole bunch over here and maybe some back over there. You might want to avoid them after the talk. I would argue that zombies do not have an amygdala. This is the part of the brain where fear responses are initiated and the place where fear memories are stored. And zombies don't really seem to fear anything. They're hungry, and they keep going after that brain, even if the person who has that brain in their head is mowing them down with a shotgun or an axe or whatever it is. They just keep going. So zombies don't have an amygdala, or not a functional one anyway. Now, the amygdala actually acts in concert with a couple of other regions in the brain, known as the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex. So I told you that the amygdala is where fear responses are initiated. So the amygdala sends signals to other parts of your brain that say, oh, get the heart pumping, get the adrenaline rushing, get the palms sweating. And the hippocampus encodes information about where we are. And it also encodes other things about memories. And it interacts with the amygdala to help us understand whether we're in a scary place. So that blood red hallway, for instance. And the prefrontal cortex gets information from both the amygdala and the hippocampus and helps make an overall decision like, yes, oh crap, we are scared. There are zombies. Please run away or fight them or freeze and hide. Or it says, no, actually, that's an itty-bitty harmless spider. We're okay. Or, you know, there is one zombie, but it's way over there and we have an axe. So I think we're okay. So the prefrontal cortex sort of helps us make those decisions. Now, what's interesting about these different parts of the brain is that if you look at patients with anxiety disorders, these different parts of the brain activate a little bit differently. So patients with post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, will often have in their brain scans an overactive amygdala and an underactive prefrontal cortex in these certain parts of the prefrontal cortex. So that indicates that maybe these fear responses are a little bit off. If you are wondering how we know so much about the brain and fear, It's because we can actually study fear in a lab, and it doesn't look anything like this one, unfortunately. If you were to participate in a study where we were learning about fear in the brain, you would walk into what would probably look like mostly a modern office building. You would sit down at a desk and sign away your life on various papers. You would sit down at a computer and things would happen. And then you'd probably fill out some surveys. And more things would happen. Until maybe you were afraid of just that picture on the screen. And I saw some startled responses. That's the, maybe a few fear faces in the audience. Fear faces look like this. Wide eyes, wide mouth. Zombies don't do that. And this process of learning fear in the lab, we call fear conditioning. So this is when we pair a stimulus like the balloon zombie, a picture, or a stimulus that you wouldn't normally be afraid of, and we put that together with a stimulus that's really terrible, like a really loud white noise. And slowly over time, if we did that a lot, you would learn to fear that balloon zombie. And that's called fear conditioning. This is actually a form of Pavlovian conditioning. So how many of you have heard of Pavlov? Yay! So yes, Pavlov, as many of you know, was the one who rang a bell and gave his dogs food, and he realized that after a while he could ring the bell and they would start salivating even if he didn't give them food. So you can do this with pleasant stimuli as well. It doesn't have to be negative, like fear conditioning. But if we're interested in anxiety disorders, we're interested in learning fear, but we're also interested in reducing fear. And that is a process called extinction. And that is, we show you the stimulus that we've made you afraid of over and over again, or over a long period of time, until slowly you reduce your fear to that stimulus. So I'm gonna leave the balloon zombie up for a while, just to make sure that the next time you play Plants vs. Zombies, you're not terrified every time the balloon zombie comes on the screen, because that would be terrible. So extinction is actually very similar to a process that a lot of anxiety patients go through that's called exposure therapy. And exposure therapy is exposing yourself to the stimulus that you fear. It works often well with phobias. It is sometimes harder with other anxiety disorders to face your fear, if you will. But it's easy when you're scared of a balloon zombie. And so we use these processes of fear conditioning and then fear extinction to model in the lab the process of learning fear in an anxiety disorder and then helping to reduce that fear over time.
So if you're afraid of clowns, you should expose yourself to clowns?
Oh my God, that's illegal.
I don't recommend that version of exposure. maybe with the help of a therapist.
How's the therapist
going to
get the button undone?
But yeah, exposure to things you fear over time and starting small. So you might first look at pictures of clowns and then eventually... Yes, not that kind of picture. So one of the interesting things I learned when I started graduate school, and part of the reason that I study anxiety disorders, is that 8 out of 10 Americans will actually experience a traumatic event in their lifetime. This could be a rape, a vehicle accident, a car accident that's really terrible. It could be going off to war. It could be any number of things that qualify as traumatic incidents in your life. But only 1 out of every 10 of those actually develop post-traumatic stress disorder. So there's this disparity between the number of people who experience a traumatic event and those who actually develop post-traumatic stress disorder. And it seems like some people are actually resilient to that disorder. And so in the lab, I'm actually trying to understand, using an animal model, how we might determine who is resilient and who is maybe vulnerable to post-traumatic stress disorder, with the hope that we can either prevent people from getting post-traumatic stress disorder or at least screen people and try to keep them away from traumatic situations if we can. So that's what I'm doing in the lab. And in a moment, I will take more questions. But I would like to thank my lab, the Wachiels. It's actually two labs, the Achiels and the Watsons. We call ourselves Wachiels. And the companies that made my presentation pretty. But I also wanted to give you a brief spiel about RELATE. It stands for Researchers Expanding Lay Audience Teaching and Engagement. And we are a brand new organization at the University of Michigan. My co-founder, Elise, is here tonight in the audience. And our outreach coordinators, Brooke and Katie, other Katie, Parzik, are also here. And our faculty, Paula and Leah Bricker, are also here. Faculty and staff. But we are trying to encourage STEM graduate students to give research talks that are useful to lay audiences. So when we talk to each other, we talk a lot of science and we talk a lot of jargon. But that doesn't work when we're talking to other people. So we're trying to teach and then do outreach, like with audiences like yourselves. And so over the summer, we had an 8-week workshop where a bunch of graduate students came and learned things. And then you may have seen, if you've come to previous Nerd Nights, a number of other RELATE speakers. And then we also had another outreach series going called Science by the Pint. And science, yes, just like almonds. And brains. Science by the Pint will be back again in this coming year, and RELATE will also be back. So we hope that if you come back to Nerd Night, you'll see a number of our other RELATE speakers. But we're excited to be here, and we're excited to be partnered with Nerd Night because it's really awesome. So I will give you things in case you're interested. Thank you.